are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 18th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, editor-at-large of New York Magazine, Rebecca Traister, author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Also on the program today, following the release of a damning Mueller memo that shows he was directed to lie, Michael Flynn to be sentenced today. Meanwhile, St. John McCain's last reminder that he was a pretender. The Arizona losing candidate Martha McSally will be appointed senator from Arizona. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Warren wants the government to manufacture generic drugs. That's right. And the vulture capitalist who skinned Sears alive and destroyed its workers give themselves a bonus. Homelessness arises in the shadow of the continuing to grow wealth inequality in this country, and U.S. student debt has doubled since the recession to $1.5 trillion. And Amazon Kush Cuomo implements Governor Nixon's proposal, says pot to be legal in New York State next year. And while Tucker Carlson losing advertisers because he's an ass, and Patreon fires back, and lastly, Republican leaders look to beg Donald Trump to not shut down the government, ladies and gentlemen. It is a Tuesday. Just a little programming note. I am going to introduce our guest, which we pre-taped earlier, and then I'm going to skedaddle. I've got to go do a... I never do this. You know, I get asked that to do MSNBC during the day, and blessedly I say I can't because I've got my own show, and I've got to do that because more often than not, I mean, it's no... Well, maybe it is, but no offense to any of the daily shows on MSNBC. It just tends to be not my fare. Do you know what I mean? But occasionally I'll do it, but for the most part I won't. But today we're pre-taping a Chris Hayes, like, Christmas year-long special, which I'm actually pretty excited about. The I think Eddie Gloud is one of the guests. Who are the other ones? Let's see. Who do we have here? Tag team partners?
What's your tag team partner, Ruben?
Dave Rubin? What? What are you talking about?
Jennifer Rubin.
Oh, Jennifer Rubin? No. It's all people on the left. I mean, I guess maybe she's had a...
What about Carter Page?
Carter Page will not be there. Gosh, I don't have the list. I can't remember. But it was an impressive... All I know is Eddie Gloud and Christina Greer, but it's going to be a full hour. Whatever. We're going to record it. You'll see it. I don't even know who's going to show up. So, but that's where I'm headed. Before I go, I should remind you that 2018 has been a difficult year for human rights. I mean, frankly, I would imagine 2017 wasn't terribly better. Or frankly, 2016. But have you ever wondered how rights abuses are documented around the world? You probably have. With the sheer volume of global crises we're seeing, from civilian casualties in Syria to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar to the caging of children on U.S. borders, it's critical that we expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. Human Rights Watch does just that. They are an independent nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy, often in partnership with local activists and human rights groups. They accept no money from any government, but they rely on the support of informed, dedicated people just like you. So if human rights are important to you, visit hrw.org/majority to make a donation and support its vital work around the world. That's hrw.org/majority. When you do, not only is your gift tax deductible, it will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. That means your donation will go twice as far to advance justice and defend the basic dignity of people who need it most. Again, that's hrw.org/majority. Oh, and this is a great gift. There's still time. And actually, this is a perfect gift if you are like some people I know and have not given their Christmas gifts yet. Have you got yours, Matt?
I got a third of them.
Yeah, right. Well, you got a whole 5 days left, buddy. Is it 5 days? Well, I guess you got a little bit more. Does it always fall on the 25th?
Every
Christmas?
Time.
Every time. All right. That's weird. Anyways, I got this for my folks last year. It's just wrapping up. I may actually extend it. Storyworth makes it easy and fun for your loved ones to share their stories so you can get to know them in a whole new way with questions you've never thought to ask. You can purchase a subscription for someone you love, and each week, Storyworth will send them an email with a question about their life. You're building basically a memoir for... It's a great gift for your parents, your grandparents. They simply reply with their story. They can record it over the phone by calling the StoryWorth number. All stories are private, only shared with the family that you choose. You can easily and securely save and edit all your stories on StoryWorth.com. After a year, the stories will be bound into a beautiful keepsake book. StoryWorth brings families together every week. It's a great way to connect with your loved ones, learn about your relatives, and preserve your memories for future generations. StoryWorth makes a great gift for the holidays for any of your loved ones who enjoy telling stories. To be honest with you, it's a great thing to do, to send to your parents and then give to your kids. Or just send to your parents so you have it as a record of the family. Both my folks are just wrapping up theirs now. So we're going to bind them and probably make, I don't know how many of the books we'll make, because I'm going to give them to my sisters. I'll probably give them to my kids. And I'll probably give them one to my parents. It's one of those deals. That's the way you got to do your gifts, you know. And it's fascinating. These are questions that, you know, you just don't think to ask. For $20 off, visit storyworth.com/majority when you subscribe. That is StoryWorth.com, STORY, Worth, WORTH.com, /majority for $20 off. We're going to take a break in a second. I will remind you, if you are a member of this program, today you're either going to get, you're going to get an audio file in your member feed, right? We'll release that later today. Of the, and I put it in quotes, the debate I had. It was really an interview. It was really an interrogation.
A dialogue.
It was a dialogue, but it really was a, what do you call it? Interrogator? No. What would you call that?
Inquisition?
No, there's another word for it. But the point is that this guy, Brandon Tarkatov, what is it? I'm sorry.
Yeah, you got it.
Wait, no. Like, what is
Brennan Straka.
Okay. I get him confused with the former television executive from the 70s, Brandon Tarkatov.
Right.
Okay. So anyway, Brandon Straka, he's a guy who set up a thing called Walk Away, which was, I guess, an attempt to influence the midterm elections. And if it did influence the midterm elections, like I told him to his face, if I was the head of the Democratic Party, I would pay him to do it again. Because it was not only not successful, it was whatever the opposite of totally unsuccessful, of being successful could be. And, it probably did more harm than good. And so we were talking about him. We did a full 10 minutes out of the, 15 hours we did that week, or the hundreds of hours we did this year. We did 10 minutes on his silly video, and he got very upset about it. And so I went on a show to tell him, to say to his face what we said on the video, because there was nothing. I think I probably went a little further. And anyways, it was fun, and it's funny. It's not, you're not going to learn anything from this. There's not going to be, like when we debate the libertarians around here, it's the idea is that when you run into people, there's going to be arguments that you can employ. This is not going to be one of those situations. This is just watching me be, as smug as I've probably ever been in my life in a public setting. And so if you're a member of the program, or if you you're a Patreon, you will get access to it. And check the member post. We'll put a link to the video in it as well, so you can watch it. And you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Do it now. You will have access to all our archives, of course. All right, folks, quick break. When we come back, I'll be talking to Rebecca Tracer, and then Mike will be doing the fun half. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the writer at large at New York Magazine, author of All the Single Ladies, and now the equally as New York Times bestselling Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, Rebecca Tracer. Welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me back, Sam.
All right, so let's just, I'm struck by, let's start with just how you decided to write a book about anger, because in many respects, well, I don't want to say all respect, but in many respects, your personal journey with this issue is mirrored in the country contemporaneously all around us.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that is true about my professional work that's been going on now for, 15 years, I've been a feminist journalist for 15 years, and anger has always undergirded my work. I write about gendered and racial and economic inequality. I write about progressive politics. I write about the women's movement and its many iterations. And you wouldn't do that work if you weren't angry. So it's not as though that is new. But one of the things, you asked how I came to write this book. One of the things that became clear to me is I have also, in my work as a journalist, sort of tried not to lead with anger, because I know that women's anger, I know from the history of how women's movements are caricatured and characterized, how progressive movements and women within them are caricatured as troublemakers, as disruptive, as hysterical, as illegitimate, as particularly for women of color, as threatening and militant, how progressive disruptiveness is characterized as mob-like, right? We see a lot of examples of that right now. And because of all that, all those messages that, in fact, have been internalized over my, 43 years on this earth, I have taken care to not make anger my the primary register with which I express myself. I have taken care in my writing to sort of make anger easier, my anger, the anger that necessarily undergirds the kind of work that I do, more palatable to, to be funny and lighthearted and cheeky and ironic. And And I haven't wanted to look too hard at either the anger that I cover. I haven't wanted to portray some of the people and figures that I cover as angry, or present myself as angry, because I know that for women and for lots of kinds of marginalized, vulnerable people, anger becomes a liability. Anger undermines your message. And in the wake of the 2016 election, there was so much anger bubbling, and I found it hard. The way I put it in my own head was, it was hard for me to think straight because I was so angry. And it was like seeing the anger not as a clarifying or instructive force or reaction, but as an obstructive one, as something that clouded my thinking. And, you know, it was in a personal conversation I had with my husband where I sort of expressed just that thought, like, you know, I'm trying to figure out what my next set of responsibilities is as a writer, as a white feminist, as a, you know, somebody looking at progressive politics. What's my work going forward? But I can't think clearly because I'm so angry. And my husband sort of said in passing, well, maybe you should write about anger. And it was just this, you know, bare suggestion that I was like, oh my God, what if I look directly at the anger, the thing that we're supposed to sort of cover over or put to the side or not stare directly at, that undergirded, that was the thing that led me to write this book. And it was incredibly revelatory and freeing, and I learned a lot, because I learned about how the degree to which we're all discouraged from considering anger as its own, as politically consequential, as a potent force in social and political movements, when in fact it always has been. And so it was really the process of writing the book was like lifting a curtain on a thing we'd been trying to take care not to look directly at or deal directly in for so long. And it was, I've learned so much just by the act of sort of taking the anger, not just my own, it's not about my anger, but the anger of women who have preceded me and who have been angry long before I ever made it to this earth. Taking that anger seriously and looking at what it's wrought, the way it's changed laws, norms, customs, protections, how it has been the propellant force behind so many social movements. It's been incredibly surprising, and I've learned so much.
All right. Okay. All right, because I feel like I have now 8 questions I want to ask simultaneously, but I know that's not fair.
I think I just answered 8 questions simultaneously.
I want to just keep it sort of somewhat sort of like a personal, and then I want to get to that sort of the more of the role of anger in the context of progress for women, and then we'll get into sort of how. Anger is received, and expressed differently, obviously, between men and women and differently situated women. But that quality of being aware, and I feel like every woman must, to some degree or another, have an awareness that there is a danger in expressing anger in a way that's not dangerous for men. And
yes, of course.
To what extent do you think the election of Trump as an inciting event, like, sort of raised people's consciousness to how much they were suppressing, or simply said, like, you know what, I'm done with the suppressing?
I think it was a combination of factors. I think that the I think that the shock of it, and by shock of it, I mean, like, I was somebody who covered Hillary Clinton's campaign. I was not shocked that Hillary Clinton lost the presidency. Simultaneously, if this makes any sense, I was shocked that Donald Trump won.
Right.
Shocked into almost a point of paralysis, like the reality settling in of the fact. I was not surprised that Hillary Clinton didn't win, but the fact that the man who did win is the president was a shock to the system, right? And I think I'm not alone in those things, even though it seems like they don't make sense.
Well, the idea is that he should have been disqualified because of who he was in some way. Obviously, there's no official to step in and say, you're disqualified. But the country should have disqualified the guy regardless of any of the shortcomings that Clinton may have had as a candidate.
Right. So here's what – there are two things – well, there are a million things, but a couple things stand out about what happened in the wake of that election. One is that it was such a shock for so many people, and there were – you know, I cover women in politics. I wrote about Hillary Clinton for a long time. That, to some degree, explains why I wasn't surprised that she lost, right?
Yeah.
For a lot of people who don't – you know, who aren't looking at the history of women in politics, who aren't looking closely at Hillary Clinton and her campaign in the way that I was for really almost a decade – I think that her loss was a shock. There was the expectation, and in part, this ties to the next thing I'm going to say. It's born out of a pernicious set of lies that Americans like to tell themselves all the time throughout our history, which is that the inequities on which this country was built have been rectified. They've been addressed. They've been fixed. The great lie that is told people who, from the start in this country, have been rendered marginal or who have been subjugated or oppressed in some way, is that it's been fixed now, that the inequities are in our past. And we saw an example of that during the Obama administration, when the notion that Barack Obama had been elected president somehow supplied this and grounded a myth that racism was a thing of our past, when in fact we know that, of course, it's not. Of course it's not. But there was a way in which you could say, well, look, you know, a black man is president, like how, you know, anything is possible. This is not racism. We solved it. The civil rights movement solved it. The abolition movement solved it. Barack Obama solved it. It's done.
The Supreme Court basically said that in their gutting of the Voting Rights Act.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That is what they said. This is no longer a problem that plagues us. We no longer need these protections. Okay. Now, that is part of, and the same thing happens around gender. The same thing, and we've heard it. We're bathed in it, right? There are more women on college campuses than there are men. In fact, there's the boy crisis in education. There's, you know, who is, like, we've solved this twice. We've had an inevitable presidential candidate who is a woman. Then won both times. I don't know if you heard. She was inevitable. It's weird that she hasn't been president yet because she was totally inevitable. This is a done deal. And in fact, part of why people assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to win is because of all the sort of structural stuff that had historically kept women from the presidency or even a nomination from a major party for the presidency. Stuff like they didn't have the support of their party. They didn't have the fundraising capabilities that their male peers had. You know, Hillary Clinton anticipated all those things that had kept Shirley Chisholm from winning a nomination in 72. Shirley Chisholm, who had neither the full-throated support of her white feminist allies in the movement, her activists, allies, or the Congressional Black Caucus, her colleagues in the House of Representatives. She talked about that she didn't have the sort of structural institutional support. She didn't have the fundraising money. In 1987, Representative Pat Schroeder thought about running for president. She couldn't raise the money, and she didn't have the support of her party. These were part of the structural impediments that had been in women's ways. Hillary Clinton wanted to be president. She tried twice. She knew what the impediments were. She gamed the system. She's like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to get the support of my party, and I'm going to get the fundraising money. Well, that made her appear to be part of the establishment, which she is. It's not just an appearance. And sort of took away the notion that everybody was like, oh, there was a sense that it didn't even matter that she was a woman because she was the establishment candidate. She was the one who was coming in with more power than anybody else, right?
Right.
And that, of course, wound up working against her in 2016. But all of that is founded, all the beliefs to be able to say that a woman candidate for president is inevitable. And people did say this about Hillary in 2008, and they said it again in 2016. It functions alongside that sort of Supreme Court, like we can gut the Voting Rights Act. We could never say in this country it is utterly dishonest to ever suggest that a nation that has never had a woman president, that has until 2016 never had a woman nominated by a major party for the presidency, that has never had a woman vice president, that a woman would inevitably become the president. That is a lie, and it's part of a far more pernicious lie that is attached to all this. Look, post-feminist thought, there was an anti-feminist backlash in the 80s and 90s that undergirded this. There's no longer anything for women to be angry about. This was especially true for white middle-class women who, of course, did reap many of the benefits of the civil rights and women's movements of the 1960s and 70s, and did reap the benefits of affirmative action at higher rates than almost anybody else, and did have all kinds of middle-class white women who got all kinds of rights and protections extended to them. And those were a lot of the women who sort of swallowed this notion that there was no longer, if they were angry about what they perceived to be sexism or misogyny, unequal power in the world, that anger was probably illegitimate because it's not true, right? That is the lie. We solved it. There are more women on college campuses. There's an inevitable woman president. Things are fine for women. Now, what Donald Trump winning the presidency did, and it's not just this, it was expose that even the women who basically won white patriarchy, even Hillary Clinton, a wealthy woman who had gamed out the system, who had gotten institutional support, who was wildly qualified to be president, could still be beaten by this cartoon character of juvenile incompetence and racism and xenophobia and sexism. That made undeniable that women had something to be mad about, right? And it's in the same way you saw a similar thing happen around the hashtag MeToo movement in the fall of 2017, when many of the most prominent complainants about sexual assault and harassment were not only middle-class white women, but extremely wealthy white actresses who lodged some of the, who told some of the first stories about Harvey Weinstein.
Right.
These were women who, you know, would have been told, like, what if they're rich, they have power in Hollywood, they're, you know, they have every advantage and every privilege, and yet they could still tell stories about how the arc of their career was fundamentally shaped by assault, about how they had experienced the, you know, in many cases, physical violence, sexual violence, or, you know, harassment, how they had been sidelined, how they had had less power in a situation. A lot of this made people aware of and better able to give voice to the fury that they felt and have things to pin it on. The same is true of Christine Blasey Ford, a middle-class white woman, advanced degree. You know, it was evidence. There's evidence out there that it's not, everything is not equal, that there are still power imbalances. And that is, it's a period, a window in which we are, there's ample evidence to correct the pernicious lie that America tells itself over and over again, which is that inequity is a thing of its structural, systemic inequity is a thing of its past. But what that means is that it's brought a lot of middle-class white women to anger in a way that they haven't been before. And that is the population that is sort of newly awakened to its anger. And it stems from the shock of seeing Hillary Clinton lose the presidency and also the realization that, okay, now I can point to certain things and say, I have every reason to be mad. You can't tell me that my anger is illegitimate.
I mean, in the perniciousness of that lie, it seems to me, is even greater, or was even greater than the lie that we tell ourselves about race, because it almost didn't even have to be articulated. You know, I mean, like I feel like there was, you know, the Supreme Court is going to make an argument like we don't have racism anymore because they have to almost. It was right. Almost the notion that there was not this sort of a deep misogyny in the, you know, interwoven into our American psyche. It was almost as if that argument didn't even have to be made. It was so accepted that it wasn't there on some level.
Well, there are different, there are things about a gender power imbalance that are very particular to the nature of the fact that, you know, women are an oppressed majority. It's a very unusual structural reality, right?
Right.
There are more women than there are men. And yet, women are subjugated and oppressed and offered less economically, socially, sexually, professionally, in the public sphere. And that creates a number of crazy dynamics, including that every woman has men in her life, and every man has women in his life. And that means when you, and that's one of the reasons that it is, the women's movement is explosive, it is combustible, it is always precarious, and it really only coheres, sort of, if you look at the historical story, only about every 50 years. It's very hard to converge around a movement that wants to challenge gendered power imbalances. And that's because the nature of gender relationships, which are familial, social, sexual, romantic, you know, within a community, means that if you challenge those gender imbalances, you are disrupting intimate personal relationships.
Right.
And that is different from other kinds of social and even identity politics disruptions within power structures, because it means fighting a battle that might have consequences in your bed, at your kitchen table, at your Thanksgiving dinners, right? It's changing dynamics of romantic and marital partnerships. It's changing dynamics within the offices in which you work. And that is it's hard to get people to have that fight because it disrupts the dailiness of their lives.
And so it's both, it seems, the stakes and the constraints. So, I mean, it's both like the price that you could pay, but also just structurally, there's not even the room to take a step back and assess because it's so
right,
daily.
Because, well, it's all kinds of things. These are intimate relationships with the people we love, You know, it's one of the reasons that the conversation around sexual harassment, you know, there have been so many iterations of this. You know, this has been a building awareness starting in the mid-70s when women began filing some of the first sexual harassment lawsuits. Many of them were women of color who were borrowing from civil rights law to, you know, and sort of using the things that they had learned, you know, via fighting for legal protections around race and applying them to the treatment that they were getting within offices. And that led to the sort of naming of a behavior that was that came in the 1970s to be called sexual harassment, worked its way up through the Supreme Court. In 1986, there's a Supreme Court decision that banned sexual harassment under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Then in 91, you have Anita Hill describing the sexual harassment she experienced while working with Clarence Thomas. It, of course, does not stop his ascent to the Supreme Court. In fact, his place on the Supreme Court it leads to and is part of the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, which indirectly leads to or directly leads to the election of Donald Trump. Right? You can draw a direct line between all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But it is also true that Anita Hill's testimony also leads to a record, you know, year, the next year, the first year of the woman, in which a record number of women are elected to office. It leads to a broader conversation around sexual harassment. But when you talk about these things, one of the reasons it takes so long is because it means changing behaviors. Like there are so many, we are intimately dependent on and connected to some of the, I write in the book that it means the bad guys are in many cases also our good guys. Right? They are our colleagues and our friends and our boyfriends and our husbands and our fathers and our sons. And that's why you can hear this language of intimate reliance and intimate loyalty. For example, in the pushback against after the Kavanaugh hearings, when you heard so many women deployed actually on behalf of white patriarchal power saying, well, our sons are vulnerable. This is what Donald Trump says. It's a very scary time for young men. The notion of maternity, we have to protect our boys. Those are the kinds of relationships that are thrown into disarray when you have a mass conversation and desire to revise the rules of a game that a lot of people are deep into their lives having already played.
Right.
And so, you know, that makes these things really complicated because if you change the rules mid-game, some people who you love and who you're attached to, who you're dependent on, either whether it's emotionally or economically because they're the breadwinners or they're your bosses or they're your mentor who gave you your, you know, and they may have behaved in ways that you can intellectually acknowledge are bad, but there are real perils and costs, emotional, professional, and political, to saying, look, you violated these rules that we're now going to be enforcing, and you've got to face repercussion for them. These are complicated challenges to make because there are costs that wind up being personal. The disruption of marriages, I write in my book about how some of the women's activism that we've seen erupt over the past 2 years, women who'd previously not been politically active, who'd been perhaps voted Democrat, but mostly had been kind of sleepwalking, kind of, you know, passive in their political investments, and are now devoting their every hour to activism, to electing candidates, to participating in teacher strikes and labor disputes. Those women often, they're talking increasingly about their marriages ending, about divorce, because the terms in which they'd entered their marriage, you know, had changed. They were now different people. They want different things from their partnerships and from the way that they organize their lives, and marriages are ending. And we know that that was used against the second wave women's movement because it did change assumptions about who was permitted what kinds of opportunities and who, you know, who should have what kind of power within our most intimate relationships. And the divorce rate spiked
right.
in the 1970s.
All right.
And anti-feminists used it against them and say, look, feminists hate marriage. They ended all these marriages in the 70s. These are really complicated changes to try to make.
Because like you say, it's on both ends. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh was up there. He was very angry because he was raised in such a way that I was allowed to do that as a kid. And that was the agreement that I made when I got born, that I will, you know, as long as I keep it back in the, you know, in college and maybe, you know, my youthful indiscretions, then I could go on and do this. And I get a gimme. And you're trying to change.
I like fear.
Right.
I like beer, and you're telling me that I'm not allowed to be angry in my love of beer?
Right. Yes, I mean, no. That was
but it was kind of that's kind of code. That was kind of right? Because
right.
he wasn't copping to the thing he was actually being accused of, which is assault of a woman. But he was, that's a great, I mean, in fact, the beer thing, and the sort of defense of a certain kind of social life that he had that we know is quite closely connected to the kinds of allegations that were made against him. It was a sort of like, this is how I live my life, and I had my calendars like my dad, and I love beer, and I, you know, Squee or whatever his name was, right? Like,
right.
There was a sense
we,
of this was...
We all, when we go to this course, we all know this is the rule. We all get the mulligan, and you're telling me that
right.
the mulligan doesn't count anymore, and
right.
that mulligan, of course, was built upon the oppression and suppression and the physical violence against women, and he felt like, well, but I didn't do it since then, theoretically, and, you know, that
probably,
type of probably.
Right.
I mean, I'm giving maybe the benefit of the doubt. But, all right, so I want to just circle back, though, because this was – there was a lot of things that came together between Donald Trump's win and Hillary Clinton's loss. And, you know, one dynamic that just strikes me is that I don't know if you you read that book of The Persistence of the Color Line by Randall Terry, and his
I haven't read it yet.
His argument it was many years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago.
And
he argued that, you know, Barack Obama could not talk about race and could not engage in race, and could not show anger because it would have destroyed everything. And certainly Hillary Clinton, like, anger at a time where there's an anger in the country, she's not allowed to access it because of the way that anger is perceived by women. So basically one arrow that would have been there for any politician who was not a woman, that's taken out of the quiver at that point, right?
That is exactly right. And she was running against two men on both her left and her right who were able to access anger, and they both used it quite masterfully, right? And my politics are on the side of one of those guys, which, you know, Bernie Sanders, speaking with righteous fury about economic inequality and the 99% and the, you know, that he was able to channel the rage of millions of his supporters who were feeling, for my, you know, in my view, had every reason in the world to be livid, and he was able to be a voice of that and wag his finger and shake his head and pound a podium. And Donald Trump, whose politics are anathema to me, I mean, you know, he was able to challenge a rage coming from a sort of a base that was furious about the perceived incursions on its status and its power, and he was able to channel a fundamentally racist, xenophobic, misogynistic fury through a you know, truly, in many cases, direct calls to violence. I mean, in the old days, we used to take protesters out, and they, you know, right? He was able to actually give voice to a punitive, you know, not just borderline, but sometimes directly violent rage that had racist and sexist implications to talk about, you know, to talk about those fears that obviously worked for his base. And Clinton, when she tried to be angry, first of all, I mean, this is a woman who is raised, also born in an era in which this was completely verboten, the raising of the female voice, you know, had actually been a young adult at the moment of the second wave women's movement. But she had already, you know, she had been raised in a country that had no tolerance, made no space for the fury of, especially of powerful women who were threatening male power in any way. It is inauthentic when she tries to, you know, transmit rage. She would sometimes thunder into her microphone, and what would everybody, by the way, including me, do is rear back and say, stop yelling, because we're not used to hearing that.
Well, even going back to 92 when she said, I'm not going to be baking cookies in the kitchen or something, and I was no fan of Bill Clinton at that time either, but that the reaction to that was just, I mean, that dynamic, you know, is like, reminds me of like when Steven Spielberg did his first movie and it was a bust, and then he decided, I'm only making huge hits from now on that are less nuanced. I felt like that was her moment where she was like, all right, now I've got to change my hairdo and et cetera, et cetera. But so she.
I think the one that came before that was when she was blamed for her husband losing re-election in Arkansas because she kept her own maiden name. Where it was like, what are you gonna? I mean, that was 1980, and after he lost his re-election bid in Arkansas, the press said it was because his wife wouldn't take his name. And that's when that for me was like the first moment in like the transformation into Darth Vader is like the moment that like she then, and she writes about it with actually incredible candor in various places about that moment where she realized she had to become Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Okay, so we take that forward. She's learned those lessons because those are lessons society. But it not only takes that arrow out of her quiver, it forces her at that point to use an arrow maybe that she doesn't want to use, right? Which is like maybe being too optimistic in some respects. But if you can't differentiate one way because it's not available to you, part of the problem is it forces you to avail yourself of another option that is suboptimal. But leaving that aside, so going from there, let's talk about the Me Too thing, because it seems to me that Me Too was a sort of a surrogate for Donald Trump. Like the country did not hold this guy accountable for the obvious, like, because the difficulty is always like it's a he said, she said type of situation. And, you know, we can't know what happens when two people shut the door or why, but in this instance, it was clear to everybody, right? There's like literally like tape. And it was the message to women that, like, even when we don't have these evidentiary questions, even when we all know what the truth is, still not going to hold him accountable. It feels like Me Too came out of like, we couldn't get Donald Trump, but we can get other people. And I don't mean to be saying this like it was like just vindictive. It was about time, but it was like there's an overdue debt of justice here, and we're going to go for that on some level. And what's your sense of that?
Well, yes and no. I think I agree. I think that I agree with you that, for example, I don't think the fall of 2017 hashtag Me Too movement, I don't think that it would have had the staying power or exploded in the way that it did had Donald Trump not been president.
Right.
On the other hand, I'm not sure which is the symptom and which is the cause, right? I think Donald Trump himself, it's like, think of the number of men who, in fact, wound up facing repercussion during that Me Too, during the 2017 hashtag Me Too movement. And we should say that, of course, the Me Too movement was founded by Tarana Burke in 2006, specifically to address sexual violence in communities of color. And the hashtag Me Too movement that was popularized in the fall of 2017 is an outgrowth of that movement, and it's a broader umbrella term to cover harassment and in a wide range of things. But I think that so many of the men, it wasn't just Donald Trump. Consider that Bill O'Reilly, like stories about Bill O'Reilly, I mean, he was sued. I wrote about a lawsuit against him for sexual harassment when I was a young journalist, probably in 2004.
Macris,
and yet he had
right?
been, yeah, Andrea Macris. And yet he kept his berth on television, a bajillion-dollar berth on television for all the intervening years. Consider Arnold Schwarzenegger, stories
yep.
about his groping had been on the record, and women had gone on the record with their names and talked about how he groped them, and he nonetheless got elected governor. Consider Roger Ailes. Stories about him had been published in Gabriel Sherman's book about him, and they had been poo-pooed by the New York Times, claimed, and nobody paid attention. He'd kept his, not only Bill O'Reilly and Roger Ailes, of course, not only kept their jobs and made millions of dollars, they also had the opportunity, given their berths to their media berths and their platforms and the power that platform that they built had, to basically contribute to the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Fox News created this president. They had so much power in addition to the wealth that they were garnering. They had so much power to control the political conversation. And this, despite having been credibly and on the record accused of acts of harassment and assault. Then you had Donald Trump. Oh, and Bill Cosby. There were many stories, public stories with names, Andrea Constant's name attached to stories about Bill Cosby. And for more than a decade, for 12 years or something, he had continued to win lifetime achievement awards, get new television deals, be hailed as a hero in some communities. So this is a buildup of, it's not just about Donald Trump. Trump was, in combination with the political fury, in combination with the surprise that many people felt at this understanding that Hillary Clinton, this qualified woman, had just been passed over for this job, for this raging racist toddler. You know, the fact is that there had been an explosion of rage in the wake of the Access Hollywood tape, and that it had not prevented him from becoming the president was like, it was like a final straw, but it wasn't all about him, right? This is the point, is that these men could be credibly accused by people, and it just didn't impede their rise to power or their further accrual of power. And it was like there was an anger that was so intense that when that story came out about Harvey Weinstein, it was like, we are not going to let this pass by. There was like, it was like a desire to hang on until these guys face repercussion. And I've never seen anything like that before. I've never lived through anything like that before. But it was like the fury. I don't think it was imaginatively, it might have been a stand-in for Donald Trump, but it was also for its own purposes.
Right.
Like, no, we are not going to be chased out of telling these stories.
Trump was the final symptom in some ways that basically said, like, this is undeniable now, and we're going to treat it on some level. The other thing that occurs to me happened during that time, or at least, I think we've seen it both sort of publicly and certainly in the context of, privately, women I know have reassessed like their realities in some way, their histories, and now realize that there were relationships that they had, work relationships, whatever, non-work relationships where they were sexually harassed. They were in some fashion suppressed or assaulted, that they, like,
or that they'd been complicit in it in somebody else's case. I mean, the whole reevaluation of once we get to the point, because if you live in a world in which all these guys and all the guys I just mentioned, right, and are getting elected president and governor and running TV networks and being hailed as heroes, and and you absorb the reality, which is that your experience of having been, assaulted by them or harassed by them or belittled or diminished or treated poorly by them just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Nobody cares. And you really absorb that. And so when you have a Me Too movement, you have something like, as has happened over the past year, where there's an acknowledgement of the damage that this behavior has wrought, it's like you finally can open up that door in your own brain and your own memory, and all the stuff that you stuffed in there, because what was going to come of really thinking about it? There was so much evidence all around us that no one cared. It didn't matter. And then when you get a sort of invitation to
and that even wasn't
it,
wrong.
It all pours out.
It wasn't even, it's almost like, it was like an assessment of nothing wrong happened. Like, it's not even like there's something wrong that happened and no one's going to care. It was like that's just normal.
Right. That's just life. That's just normal. Yes.
So where, like where, if in the wake of Donald Trump, this anger, there was this sort of, not necessarily explosion of anger, but I guess this eruption of existing anger and assessment that we should be angry, and a different expression of it. I mean, tell me, like, do you think that there has been a lasting change, A, in the ability, and to what extent has there been a change in the ability of women to be angry in, relative to men, let's say, where, a men's anger is, you mentioned Pat Schroeder. If I remember correctly, the thing that really knocked her out of the race was that she cried. Like, there was a moment where
she was announcing, when she cried, she was announcing that she wasn't going to run.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's quite right to say that that's what knocked her out, but that was the thing for which she became famous.
Yes, it was like the idea that she would cry in public. And then I feel like we've seen many examples of men cry in public, and it's like...
John Boehner never stopped crying.
Exactly. He was just...
Yes.
And it's impressive. It's impressive he was able to do that. It took a lot of guts to cry in public for that guy.
Yeah.
And... has the ability for women to be angry? Because, you know, frankly, like, I'm thinking about Elizabeth Warren. I'm from Massachusetts. I'm a big fan of hers. When I talk to people in Massachusetts who I think should also be big fans of hers, like, I almost get like the, like a unilateral, I mean, like a, I should say unanimous response. And I feel like it's a gendered response to when she gets angry. Like, she's a scold. And it's like, what?
Right. Like, so the question of, are we making material change? I do think that we are making tremendous, I think we are in the midst of changing our perceptions about how women can express themselves and be taken seriously. But we make a mistake again when we imagine that we can fix it quickly. This is hundreds of years, generation upon generation upon generation of conditioning, of social messaging around what's appropriate, around what tones are effective. This is, again, we talk about change in this country as if it's something that we can be quickly proud of having fixed. But in fact, when you're talking about a nation that has, that was baked into its initial promises of equality and liberty, were structurally enforced inequality and inhumanity, you are talking about problems that take so long to fix and that we have to be in the midst of probably for the, I mean, inevitably for the rest of our lives. So I do think that there are changes that are being made around how we, I think if you look at the way that some of these new young women are moving into Congress, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, the voices that they're using and the unwillingness to be sort of solicitous and polite, I think you're seeing that's a data point in terms of we're changing the register in which we can hear and respect and acknowledge as consequential certain kinds of women's voices. That's a huge set of changes we're seeing being wrought around that. I think that the fact that we're having conversations about how Hillary Clinton was heard, how Elizabeth Warren is heard, how Kamala Harris as an African-American woman is heard when she challenges Jeff Sessions or raises her voice as a prosecutor on a Senate Judiciary Committee. You know, she and the ways that she gets characterized as hysterical or punitive or worrying in some way. Like, we're, the fact that we're having these conversations is helping to change how we hear these women, but it's not something where we're ever in our lifetime that right. you or I is ever going to be able to say, like, well, now we love angry women. Like, it's not going to be that quick. It's a long, arduous, complicated, multifaceted process. And I want us, the thing I want this book to do more than anything, and people often understand it to be like a call to raise your voice in anger, and it's not that, actually, because there's still so much, there's so many ways in which women are punished in one way or another for offering loud challenge, right? So I would never encourage, you know, if you're a woman of color who's pulled over by a cop for no reason, you have right. every reason in the world to be livid, but if you voice that fury, you risk your life, you know? If you're a woman who is paid unequally in her office, you have every reason to be furious, but if you raise your voice about it in your office, you're going to get a reputation perhaps as difficult, or you're not going to get that raise, or you're going to get fired. You know, there are real costs to that. So my book is not about not trying to encourage people to speak differently. It's to listen differently. It's to listen for these patterns. It's to listen to the patterns in our own head that write off women whose voices are raised in angry or disruptive dissent as, you know, complicated or hysterical or too much. Stop, think, start listening to anger of marginalized people, including women, as instructive and diagnostic, as politically and socially potent. I want us to listen differently, to receive women's anger differently, and to watch for the patterns in which it is discounted and dismissed, and in our own heads and more broadly. That's part of the work of changing things, but that is going to be the work of our lifetime.
The it's a long-term project to get people to listen differently, to hear it differently and whatnot. The other thing that has, I think, you know, obviously come in the wake of this is that, and Thetiscopel and Lena Putnam, I think it was, and even, you know, the Intercept stories about what was happening on the ground show, you know, I think were indicative of a rising activism, and I think you mentioned, of women who had otherwise been maybe a reliable Democratic vote, maybe midterms, maybe, but now are running for office, are at the forefront of of activist groups in terms of, particularly in the context of elections, I think just like stumbled into multiple, essentially groups of women who were organizing to send money to like, a state race in Colorado across the city. That energy you don't need. What's your feeling about the that engagement, that level of energy, where that's going to be within 5 or 10 years? I mean, if the listening and getting society obviously to change their knee jerk reactions to women's anger is a long term project. What about that involvement? I mean, have there been like a generation or two of women whose political engagement is forever implicated?
Well, I hope so. This is an open question, and it depends. This is why I get anxious when I hear this all just tied to Trump, because in part, you know, I certainly hope that Trump is going to be gone soon, you know, and in 2 years, or, you know, even if it's in 6 years. God, I hope not.
Right.
You know, it's not, that's why I get anxious whenever somebody ties this directly to being about Donald Trump, because Donald Trump in this regard is absolutely symptomatic. He is the thing that has made the project of the American right wing evident, because he's, you know, he just says all the quiet parts loud. But if we attach it too much to Trump, then there'll be this myth again, that pernicious but seductive myth that we fixed it. Oh, we got rid of Trump. It's done. But in fact, we know that it's not done, that his presidency was enabled by a party and by a set of ideologies and attitudes about who deserves to have power and who is permitted to participate equally and receive equal rights and equal protections in this country. That is, again, anger of a lifetime. Now, the question is, how many of those newly angry people will stay angry for the rest of their lifetimes? And that is up to those people, and including us. And I think that one of the big opportunities of this moment is, even if people are coming to the anger specifically, say, about Trump, I hope that part of what we're doing is having a conversation and in a period where people are really getting an education about all of the inequalities that are out there that require steady anger and vigilance and fight and commitment to being civic participants and political combatants, right? I think that the opportunity here is an education, and that's within progressive coalitions too, about the racism, the sexism, the inequality that exists within progressive coalitions. A lot of the conversations happening within a women's movement, this iteration of a women's movement, are about racism within that women's movement. And that's especially true for a lot of the suburban white women, suburban middle-class white women who are new to the anger. A lot of them are also learning about anger at them, because of the unequal amount of space they've taken up within progressive and feminist coalitions, while women of color, who often have been doing the groundbreaking intellectual and political work and have been the base of the Democratic Party for years, go underrepresented and their needs under acknowledged and within that Democratic Party and any kind of left coalition. Those kinds of conversations, I hope, which are also rooted in anger that happens within a progressive coalition, I hope are going to reshape us, so that the acknowledgement of the problems we have to solve go way beyond Trump, and I hope that it extends deep into our future. But we won't know until we get there. And this is a question. There will always be incentives for women, and particularly for white women who are adjacent to white, especially middle-class white men. There will always be incentives in place for them to quell their anger and to go back to being non-disruptors. And that is something that we have to be very attentive to, because there will be those messages that are put on offer.
Rebecca Traister, the book is Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Welcome to... Are we back? All right, welcome back, everybody. The team is here. We're going to take you into the fun half, but first we're going to do about 30, 40 minutes of plugs for our respective programs. So sit tight. But first, of course, become a member of the Majority Report, majority.fm/become a member. It is merely pennies a day to serve this 5-day-a-week news and analysis program. That really is quite a feat. Anytime I was talking I was talking to a friend, I guess for lack of a better word, in the biz the other day, and he was just like, you guys do this 5 days a week. That's an unbelievable amount of work.
We do it more than anybody.
We do. The smallest 5-day news team in the country with...
By certain measurements.
In a certain sense. It's very, very left, very strong analysis. Anyways, we are responsible, even with the advertising, over 90% of it comes from you, and that makes us responsible to you. Become a member today. JustCoffee.coop, get the deal. It's on the site. January tickets are sold out for the Majority Report show. We are more than halfway sold out of the February 1st Michael Brooks show. And I'm going to start talking to you about some of the things we're going to be doing, including a pre-recorded Dave Rubin, Sam Harris sketch. Alona Minkowski is going to be there. Bhaskar Sunkar is going to be there. Trevor Beaulieu is going to be there. Get your tickets today for the February 1st Bell House show on our website. Tonight on TMBS, we're doing a dive connecting the barbarism at the border today, the caravan, and the 2009 Obama-Clinton State Department-backed coup in Honduras, the removal of Manuel Zelaya, how that connects with a broader U.S.-backed reversal of the pink tide. Don't complain, coup! If Manuel Zelaya is compromising your coffee fields with higher minimum wage for workers, I don't see, don't come here and complain.
Don't raise the minimum wage. Yeah. Coup.
Don't raise the minimum wage. Have a coup. Then hire some creep like Lonnie Davis that has some type of bizarre incestuous relationship with Hillary to lobby for it. And then Vanessa A.B., she is for Current Affairs. She just was in France. We're talking a sort of ground-up perspective of the Yellow Vest movement. And then it ties together with an interview that is, obviously very important to me with Valeska Martins, who is one of the lead defense counsels for political prisoner Lula da Silva. And we will talk about Lawfare, that case, the U.S. role, and it will link with Honduras. And then, of course, the postgame. Thursday, we're doing another live TMBS show because we're off next week, and Big Wasni Lambre is going to be in studio. Looking forward to that very much. Jamie, what's going on?
All right. So last week on the Antifada, we had a pretty serious episode where we took apart some of the anti-immigration faux populist arguments being made by Angela Nagel, Tucker Carlson, and more, in the hopes of arming people with facts and logic that they can use to own whoever they're arguing with, or just for their own edification. So this week, we recorded a very silly episode with Alex Patak of fellow goth socialist podcast Pod Damn America, which you were on recently, right, Michael?
I just was on. I forgot to mention that. We did it. It was name of the show was Lula Lads, and I had a really fun time with Jake Flores and those guys, and I like the phrase Lula Lads very much.
Yeah, they're awesome,
they're good guys.
Nice,
check
funny
it out.
Guys.
Yes.
So we did a show with Alex Patak, and we talked about many things. We talked about how Teen Vogue is leftist now, and Penthouse is like some kind of alt-light IDW publication. Did you know about this?
I didn't even know Penthouse still existed.
Oh, it exists.
I did know my friend Samita Mukhopadhyay, I think, is at Teen Vogue, and she's got some very legit politics.
Yeah, Teen Vogue has been really good lately. Like, mm-hmm. You could read a primer on like anarchism right next to an article about like lip gloss or the Jonas Brothers or whatever teenage girls like now.
Let's wait till they get bought by some shadowy group and then laid off like a day later. Knock on wood.
It's time for
the fight, Teen Vogue.
Yeah.
Yeah,
thanks.
Solidarity.
Thanks for the optimism. Unionize as quickly as possible.
Yeah, be vigilant.
Seriously.
And apropos of nothing, Jonathan Chait is a scab in his soul.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We talked about that, too.
Oh, you did? You talked about the New York Magazine
unionizing? We talked about how the New York Magazine unionized.
Very
and Jonathan
cool.
Chait is, of course, crying about it like the little scab he is. And you know what? If the New York Magazine Union wants to bring back social unionism, where unions are fighting for the good of society and not just themselves, they will make firing Jonathan Chait one of their demands.
Yeah, if the union's bad for Jonathan Chait, it sounds like a pretty good union.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like another reason to love the union.
For real,
for
real.
All right, awesome. The Antifada. Check it out on iTunes and Patreon.
Yeah, people can still check out the Democracy in Chains episode, although they might have already because that's one of my best performing ones.
It was very good. I, if I may, an editorial suggestion. I think semi-regularly doing valuable left-wing books that have, I think a Stephen Jay Gould thing, maybe that could be a joint TMBS literary hangover, but that guy needs to be retrieved because he was really positive and really important and smeared by very awful people.
Oh, is he the IQ stuff guy?
Harvard, I think he was a paleontologist. Anyways,
yeah, right, right.
He was trashed by a guy named Nicholas Wade, who was a New York Times reporter that wrote a book that, like, he sort of wrote, like, the kind of genetic racist book that, like, the other people that want to make sort of similar arguments are like, yeah, but not like that. Mm-hmm. That guy's book was actually pretty racist.
Right.
Right? Like, a real trash piece of writing. And he was a reporter behind a lot of this revisionism around Stephen Jay Gould. It's a very important story.
Yeah.
You know, Jacobin has a good piece about it. People should check out. But anyways, go ahead. Sorry. It's a great episode.
Yeah, yeah. Coming up, I'm going to release one on Anne Bradstreet, who people might know as the first published poet in America. She was also one of the first pundits. She wrote a poem, a dialogue between Old England and New about the English Civil War, written in 1642 at the time, and then published in 1650. So she talks a lot about it. And it's very interesting because she mentions, like, commons and, like let's...
She talks about the commons?
But she's not, like, she's not a pro-commoner. She is pro-commoner, but, like, also, like, pro-land owner because her dad was literally governor of Massachusetts Bay four times. But there's some good sentiments. Like, there's like a let's abolish prisons because all this sectarian strife is why we have prisons in the first place. And then it turns to a really interventionist. Let's go to Turkey and Rome and get these papists out. And just like we did in Palestine, like 100
Hell
years
yeah.
ago. So yes,
she's like Hillary Clinton.
It's very imperial feminism, American feminism thing.
This stuff goes way back.
Way back.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
It's a nice feeling. It's real.
Double U L.
It's a nice feeling, sweetheart. Get me a beer. I totally get it. They are. You turn on the TV, some iteration of me. Zero-sum game. It's a nice feeling. Zero-sum game. Zero-sum game. It's a nice feeling. You're gonna lose your status. He's the king of his zero-sum game. I totally get it. Zero-sum game. They are. Zero-sum game. Sweetheart, get me a beer.